I'm going to deal with that. There are things we're discussing were things that my observation as I'm there yesterday, I am seeing the total denial of God. There's absolutely nothing that relates to God in this whole thing. Or if there is a relation to God, it is almost a blasphemous one, because they're treating God like he's either a non-existent being. You know, in Romans it said, professing themselves to be wise, they became fools, and they actually started worshiping and serving the creature more than the creator and so forth. So I thought, let me just take a couple minutes and go through some thoughts, kind of throwing these things together hurriedly, but starting with marriage itself. So in trying to very briefly explain to a very panicked young woman who thinks she's not married, see, the last words of that character, here's an interesting thing. This character, as they're going through the service, is laughing about everything that is said. There's laughter. And of course, none of us have a clue what is going on up there. Well, Janet, as we were leaving, Janet said, she told Doug, she said, as much as that guy's laughing, he must be half woman. I said, Janet, you didn't know what you were saying. And it was like the laughter is almost a mockery over the seriousness of the things you're supposed to be doing here. So the first error is that you allow a person to step into the priesthood who has no authority to be in the priesthood. And they had no right before God to even begin to handle something like performing a wedding because of what the wedding is, all right? So I went into Webster's 1828 and got the definition of marriage. And if you take Webster's definition of marriage and then you go in and you look at comments made by some of the old Christian writers, it's obvious that Webster must have read some of these guys in putting his definition. And he said this. He said, marriage is the act of uniting a man and woman for life. It is the legal union of a man and woman for life. So he repeats himself. Marriage is a contract, both civil and religious, by which the parties engage to live together in mutual affection and fidelity till death shall separate them. Marriage was instituted by God himself for the purpose, these are the three purposes that he puts down, for the purpose of preventing promiscuous intercourse of the sexes, for promoting domestic felicity, and for securing the maintenance and education of children. So marriage, if you have these three things, you have orderliness. I would have put it a little different way. I would have said, had they called me up there, I would have got into a little explanation, which it looked to me like needed to be given, that marriage is for the stabilization of society, first of all, because the home is supposed to be this sound institution where children are raised in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. And being raised in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, you don't have a bunch of people running around who are making up their own rules. They're going to follow the laws of God. And so you have this, and then the way Malachi said it, he when he's going through his explanation of why Israel is under the judgment of God, he names several things. But one of the things he names is that divorce had become prevalent among them. And that what he calls the putting away of the wife says God hates this putting away. So it was like they had the ability, it's kind of like the Muslim, They have the ability to say, I divorce thee, I divorce thee, I divorce thee. It is really what you call no-fault divorce. There's just one wants to put the other one away, and it's almost always the man putting away the woman. And so this occurs, and God says, look, this is not what I ordained. And then he talked about the residue and asked, why the residue? And his answer is, for the raising of a godly seed. Well, in the raising of a godly seed, you give the expression that is given in so many other scriptures with regard to child training and with regard to the relationship between the husband and wife that Jim went through on the Friday night of the meeting. He took a great deal of time to go through that relationship between the husband and wife, and was very sound. Think back. I mean, I don't know how much time he took because I didn't time it, but I'm going to say probably a good half hour just on that one issue. This is the relationship of husband and wife. So in Malachi, when God is telling them why he's judging, or the judgment that's coming, and they ask, why? Says, because the Lord has been witness, now that's a key word, witness, between you and the wife of your youth, against whom you have dealt treacherously. Yet is she thy companion and the wife of thy covenant. So we have witness and covenant. And did he not make one, yet had he the residue of the Spirit, and why one? That he might seek a godly seed. This is Malachi chapter 2. Starting in verse 14, that he might seek a godly seed. Therefore, take heed to your spirit, and let none deal treacherously against the wife of his youth. Now, in my mind, there was a treacherous dealing, even in having this person come in to do what they did. Now, these people are in one way, they're in a state of innocence, in a state of innocence in that they have never been taught anything. And even though Steph has this sense of God, and it's a true one, she does not really want to offend God, she lives in an environment, in a worldly environment, that really sees nothing offending God. God can't be offended because God's not God. So you can do anything you want to do, and you have this concept of every man doing that which is right in his own eyes and doing everything right in his own eyes. He does not consider, since it is right in his own eyes, that there's any judgment connected to it. And you can't tell them otherwise. So he said in Malachi 2:16, for the Lord God of Israel says that he hates putting away, for one covers the violence with his garment, saith the Lord of hosts. Therefore take heed to your spirit and deal not treacherously. And he says, you have wearied the Lord with your words, yet you say, wherein? How have we wearied him? And the answer is, when you say, everyone that does evil is good. So when you say, here is this person who is obviously an abomination to God. I mean, that's a biblical description. This is an abomination to God. And this abomination steps into a holy environment and conducts itself as though it is a righteous servant of God. Now, somebody handed the materials, handed the preacher's notebook, handed everything over, and said, after going through the things that were gone through, at the end, when it had to say, by the power vested in me, by the state of Ohio, I pronounce you, the voice almost disappeared. Because what is the mind saying? I don't have any power. I'm saying that I have the authority of God and of the state of Ohio to declare you to be husband and wife so that you can live together in holy matrimony, and I don't have it. And that's why Stephanie was a little terrified afterwards. Wait a minute, am I married? Even though she said up there, you know, when they said, do you take, and she stuck her hand in the air and yelled out, I do. And then she said, I am married. She really didn't know if she was. So we had to deal with that afterwards. But you have a great violation here. in Ezekiel 22 and there's two places in Ezekiel. Ezekiel chapter 22 and verse 26, he's talking about the priests. Frequently, when you go in the prophets and you find God finding fault with the nation of Israel, you find the fault in the priesthood and in the prophets, and then, of course, in the people, because if the people who are in position of leadership and instruction are teaching falsehood, what in the world are the people going to be practicing? Because they are receiving the counsel of somebody who's lying to them. So they begin to live a lie. So Ezekiel, I'm only picking out a verse here. You can read the chapter in Ezekiel 22 and verse 26. He says, her priests have violated my law and have profaned my holy things. They have put no difference between the holy and the profane. Profane means common. So you have some things are holy. Why are they holy? Because they are ordinances of God. What if we did like some of these guys were involved in the hippie movement and whatever was happening in the church back in the 80s? I think it was probably in the 80s. I don't know if it's 10. Where they started using root beer and hamburger for communion. Or they were serving potato chips and they were substituting everything under the sun and they were calling it communion. You say, wait a minute, that's not communion. This is not the body and the blood of Jesus Christ. What in the world, where is your brain that you would use root beer and hamburger and say this is the body and the blood of Christ? But people were swarming to these places because there was no concept of holy. Nothing is holy. And the ungodly, of course, love that because the ungodly do not like to be confronted with the truth that is going to bring them to a sense of guilt. Don't tell me I'm guilty of anything. So he said, the priests are the ones guilty here. The priests have violated my law and profaned my holy things. They have put no difference between holy and profane. Neither have they showed the difference between the unclean and the clean. And have hid their eyes from my Sabbaths, and I am profaned among them. So something happened in that part of the nation of Israel that was responsible for the teaching of the people so that the nation remained in a state of holiness before the Lord, because that's what they had been commanded. Be ye holy, for I am holy. It's the same thing we get in the New Testament where it's mentioned about Christ. Be ye holy, for your Father is holy. So the priests had done something horrible. Well, in the 44th chapter of Ezekiel, when God is talking about the recovery, he says, speaking of these same priests, and they shall teach my people the difference between the holy and the profane and cause them to discern between the unclean and the clean. So, what is that going to do? That's going to bring about a conflict of some sort, because here you have got people who are accustomed to being basically unclean. And suddenly you have these prophets that are brought among them, whom God has raised up, and they're a different generation, and they've gone back and looked at the law of God, and they're going to come in and teach the people what is right. You're going to have a conflict because these people are walking around saying everything we're doing is okay. And these guys walk in and say, matter of fact, nothing you're doing is okay. You're going to have to come to a point of repentance. I raised a question before I go on. I raised a question concerning our denomination. It's not a big serious question, but it is a big serious question. My question was, do you think that as the John Knox Presbyterian Church, we take a strong enough stand against civil government, which is ungodly, taking a stand against that which is not proper? Or do you think that our statement with regard to our association with government is sufficient? And then I gave a couple of illustrations, and I said, I don't know that this is something that needs to be brought up as a motion. I don't know how this works, but it is a thought. Is there some area, having just taught on education, is there an area where the church needs to say, we need to reevaluate whether our position is strong enough against state intrusion? Now, it is my understanding that the John Knox Presbyterian Church does not permit incorporation, because you can't have that illegal marriage with the state. But I was told that at least in one case, that the answer was, we are a nonprofit. Well, I don't know if, is there a nonprofit that is not a nonprofit corporation? So I don't know what legal language, and since I am not a lawyer and since I don't study in that, is there an area where you can actually be a nonprofit but not be a corporation? Now, I would say, in my thinking, the way to do that, the only way to do that, would be that in your own bylaws, you basically put in the language which restricts you, should the church fold, as to what you do with the property. Because in a nonprofit corporation, it is stated in there that should you close, you can give that property away, but you can only give it to another nonprofit. So is there language that could be put in into your own bylaws that says, here is our position with regard to the state, and here are the restrictions we place on ourselves? I would say probably you could do that, and you don't have to have some government seal on there or something. But it is an issue, and this would come down even to where we place marriage, family, education. Do we place that solely under God? Or is there room there to say we're going to put this part under God, but we don't have to put this other part under God? Anyway, it's something to ponder. Now, I thought, well, let me just think. Why do you have a public service? If you're going to do a wedding, why do you have a public wedding? Now, public wedding doesn't mean you have to have a great big thing like they had yesterday with all of those people in it. Public wedding can be before a justice of the peace, with the necessary witnesses, mayors. The mayor of Warren performs weddings, I guess, every Friday he does weddings. And but why do you have a public service? Why don't they just do this, what you call common law? Why don't they just come together, decide that they are married, and start living together, and that's it? What is it about a public service? And the answer is, in a public service, you make confession before witnesses. So it is the duty of the minister to instruct the immediate witnesses, who normally we call a maid of honor or a matron of honor or a best man. I don't even know if they had those yesterday. They had groomsmen, and they had the okay, well, I'm saying, oh, really? Okay. No, he was her groomsman.
Oh, okay.
She told me that. He was her groomsman. Okay.
I was confused by that.
Sorry. Yeah, that's...
Okay. Anyway, here are these people, and the minister, it is the job of the minister to teach the people the law of God. So when these people come and inquire about you performing a wedding, you must first say to them, I really can't give you an answer to that till we meet, and I'm going to have to give you some information, and you're going to have to decide whether you accept it or reject it. So they come. I had a woman call me. We actually had this woman's children in the academy, but she wasn't married. She had been married, I guess, and divorced. And so she wanted to get married again. And so she called me up and told me that she wanted to get married and wanted me to perform the wedding since I had the children. And I said, well, that's fine, but you're going to have to come to my class. She said, we're going to have to come to class? I said, yes, you're going to have to come take the marriage class. She hung up the phone. I never heard from them again. I don't know if she got married or not. So you say, okay, you are asking me to perform a ministry that is wholly under the Lord, and I want to make sure that we're on the same page. So you need to come and let me teach you something concerning where I'm, what I'm going to ask you to submit to. And then if you decide you don't want me to do it, okay, that's fine. But if you decide you want me to do it, then you have to understand and you go on through what it is. So part of that instruction is to explain that there are these two covenants. The first covenant is the suzerainty covenant, which is God's. You got the keys with you?
No, I didn't bring them.
Robin, do you know where the keys hang?
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's a red button on the key. Just push it. So you say, look, when you two people come in here, you are coming before God. And you are going to have to consent. In order for me to perform this, you're going to have to consent to submit to the covenant of God, which is summed up in this. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. Wives, submit yourselves to your husbands as the church is submissive to Christ. And then using the scripture Jim used, you go into 1 Corinthians and show that the head of Christ is God and the head of the man is Christ and the head of the woman is the man. You go through this and you say, here's where we have to start. Now, can you, as a woman, can you be submissive to your husband? Now, you need to explain what that means. That's not, as Jim said, that doesn't mean, you're right in the dust and you say, I am the head and you're nothing. And she says, big deal, head of nothing. That was his little story that he told. So you have to establish this with these people. I want you to understand that when you stand up in front of this crowd, that you are going to be asked in the presence of this crowd if you submit to God's covenant for marriage. And you are going to have to answer yes, or we'll stop everything right there. Because what's the point of going on? If you're going to go on and they don't submit to the covenant of God, what's the point of going on? You just have people who are going to do their own thing anyhow. So after that, the witnesses, who are this maid or matron of honor and this best man and the rest of the people, but the two primary who sign the license are the maid or matron of honor and the best man. They sign the document. And the reason their signature is on the document is, oh, there's only one reason, and that is in the event that one of these two people violates the terms of the covenant and refuses to be reconciled, that they become covenantally dead and divorce becomes legitimate under the terms of covenantal death, and these two people have to give the evidence of what they heard. I heard him swear that he's going to love her as Christ loved the church, and then whatever else the preacher put in there. I heard her swear that she would be submissive to her husband as the church is submissive to Christ. That was, so if she's off on some other tangent, listen, she's got no ground because she made this commitment. He's got no ground because he made this commitment. So this is a very serious thing. And the minister, these priests, as we read in Ezekiel, they had profaned the law of God, and so they started teaching the people this way, and they didn't even tell them about being accountable to God. Well, I'm afraid we're dealing with a lot of that today. The second covenant is the parity covenant, and that's when you get over into these vows. The first covenant is God is the superior and you are the inferior. You can't say to God, let's sit down and talk about that. Okay, this is what you want me to do. Well, we're going to have to discuss this because I'm not sure I want to do that. Let's tweak it a little. You can't, because God, that's like Billy Graham coming to the conclusion and the Pope coming to the conclusion a few years ago that it really isn't necessary to be a believer in Jesus Christ to go to heaven. If you believe in God and you have a sincere religion where God is concerned, that's all there is. Christ is not the issue. That's a lie. Because God said there is salvation in nobody but Jesus Christ. So you can't now start introducing ideas that you come up with and allow these people to believe a lie. That's the strong delusion. So you go through that, then you say to them this other part, where as equals, remember that in the catechism, when you get into the commandments, you get into this where they get into the fifth commandment, honor your father and your mother, they take some time to deal with the relationship of superiors to inferiors, the relationship of inferiors to superiors, and the relationship of equals. So in this parity covenant, you have these two equals who have already submitted to the covenant of God, who are going to make promises to each other. And these are what we call the vows. And that's where this character yesterday ran through that so fast. I'm sure that part of it was the total sense that they shouldn't be doing it. And so the voice kept dropping down, and you couldn't really hear what was being said. And going through these vows, sickness and health, poverty and wealth, etc., going through that, these witnesses are hearing this agreement so that if at some time later, because of somebody's weakness or because of what we call no fault of their own, the legitimate poor, there is not a lot of money, and they said poverty or wealth, said, you can't go running off now because you're having to live low in the hog instead of high in the hog. You can't now go running around poor bad-mouthing the other person. You made a commitment. So God say, okay, we have these witnesses. So in several places, I'm just going to run through this. God says in Deuteronomy 17:6. He says, this is about the death penalty. Deuteronomy 17, when they're talking about the death penalty. Let's see. In verse 2, it says, if there be found among you within any of thy gates, which the Lord thy God giveth thee, man or woman that has wrought wickedness in the sight of the Lord thy God in transgressing his covenant, and has gone and served other gods and worshiped them, either the sun or the moon or any of the hosts of heaven, which I have not commanded, and it be told thee, and you have heard of it, and inquired diligently, behold, it be true, and the thing certain that such abomination is wrought in Israel. Then you shall bring forth that man or that woman which have committed that wicked thing unto thy gates, even that man or that woman, and stone them with stones till they die. And then he says, at the mouth of two witnesses or three witnesses shall he that is worthy of death be put to death. But at the mouth of one witness he shall not be. So we have two witnesses in this marriage thing. You have these two people who assume this responsibility, although that mostly they're not told that. They assume this responsibility. To them, the signing of the contract is, I guess, just a ritual. It doesn't carry any weight because they don't know. But they're dealing with the death penalty, covenantal death. So that if this person covenantally dies, they are no longer, the other person is no longer bound to that covenant, and that's where divorce can come in, and that's where we need to understand when they say, till death do us part, everybody thinks only of physical death. So Bill Gothard, when he was teaching, he was so far afield that he's teaching, I mean, if this couple get married and this one person is a raging fornicator and can bring death to the other person in their relationship by the disease they bring, listen, that's, you can't do that because it's till death do you part. So you don't know about covenantal death. You don't know about covenants. You know about God. So, but he said it has to be two or three witnesses. And then over in, let me see, I want to go in order. In Matthew, And this is the one, you know this by heart, Matthew 18. This is where you've got this problem between these two people. And first he tells them in verse 15 to go individually. Okay, you got a problem, go individually and discuss the problem and see if you can't resolve it. And if you can resolve it, fine. But if not, he said, if he won't hear thee in verse 16, take with thee one or two more, that in the mouth of two or three witnesses every word shall be established. So the Lord deals with this consistently. Why do you have these two witnesses? And you can find this in a lot of places, not just in marriage. You can find that in some places they only require one, but you need these witnesses. If he will not hear thee, take with thee one or two more, that in the mouth of two or three witnesses every word shall be established. This is when you have a problem, when you have these two people, and these two people engage in some kind of a conflict, and then this one goes off and reports to its army, and this one goes off and reports to its army, and this one tells these people what this one said, and this one tells these people what this one said, and there's no verification. How do you verify it? A number of years ago, over at Shiloh Church, they had a school. And I got a call one night from a person at the church, and they were concerned about the headmaster. The headmaster apparently had spoken rudely to one of the girls in the school. This was the report anyway. And was talking to me about procedure, what do we do? And I started to talk with them, and I said, let me ask you a question. The people who filed the complaint, have they talked to anybody else? Well, yes, as a matter of fact. I said, as far as you know, have those people talked to anybody else? Well, yeah, they've talked to some folks. Well, have any of these people talked to you? Yes. I said, you corrupted your witness. When this person talked to this person, did you ever do that game where you have to this person's going on a trip and they're going to take luggage and they keep adding things on, and the whole purpose of that thing is to show how it changes as you go around. So you have person A talks to person B and they tell the story. They might even tell the story fairly well. And then B talks to C, but there's a change. And by the time this gets through a handful of people, it's been corrupted. It is not true witness. So now you bring this headmaster in and you put him on trial and you bring in these witnesses, of which none are really witnesses. That is what you call hearsay. Oh, you actually heard him say this to her. Well, no, I didn't. But listen, I know that mother is honest and she wouldn't have told me that if it didn't happen. And that girl would not have told her mother if it didn't happen. But you didn't hear him. No. We didn't hear, oh, well, then we cannot accept your testimony because it's corrupted testimony. It's hearsay. And they do that in the court of law all the time. And they'll say, you can't enter this. You can't enter this because it's hearsay evidence. It might even just be it's a conversation between two people if there is not some way of verifying. So these witnesses are essential, and the witnesses have to be some way pure. Remember, when they're putting Jesus on trial, they can't find a witness. And the law, they know the law. The law says you can't put him to death under the testimony of one witness. You've got to have two or three who will testify to the violation of the law in a capital manner so that he will actually be guilty of that violation and deserve death. So they go find false witnesses. They even had a problem doing that because nobody knew anything wrong. Had it not been the necessity of Christ atoning for sin, he probably would have got off because there's no charges that they can really file against him. So here in Matthew, we're told for two or three witnesses. In 2 Corinthians, if I run over to 2 Corinthians real quick, the 13th chapter of 2 Corinthians. My pages are getting to the point that I don't turn one, I turn eight or ten. Let's see, Galatians. 2 Corinthians chapter 13 and verse 1. He says, "This is the third time I am coming to you. In the mouth of two or three witnesses shall every word be established." So Paul is kind of like a lawyer here. Now, remember, I'm still talking about marriage. That in the mouth of two or three witnesses, why do we have this public service? Well, you have these two people who are specifically designated to be witness to what is said so that in the future, any course of action has to come back to the evidence presented by these two witnesses. And that's why you have this crowd, and the preacher will say, they might say something like, "We're gathered here in the company of these witnesses in the presence of God," or something, and gives a brief explanation. They don't do that much anymore, but they give a brief, I really need you to pay attention to what's going on here today, because you may be called upon to testify against or in behalf of one of these two people at some later date. So again, we have the two witnesses, and the last one is in Hebrews, the 10th chapter of Hebrews, where he simply is repeating, going through Hebrews chapter 10. And let's start in verse 23. "Let us hold fast the profession of our faith without wavering, for he is faithful that promised. And let us consider one another to provoke unto love and to good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day approaching. For if we sin willfully after that we have received the knowledge of the truth, there remains no more sacrifice for sins, but a certain fearful looking for of judgment and fiery indignation which shall devour the adversaries. He that despised Moses' law died without mercy under two or three witnesses. Of how much sorer punishment, do you suppose, shall he be thought worthy who has trodden underfoot the Son of God and counted the blood of the covenant wherewith he was sanctified an unholy thing and done despite unto the Spirit of grace?" So he refers back to the Mosaic law of two witnesses, and he say, look, when you're talking about the blood of Christ, it's even more severe. Well, again, if we don't make the connection, if this particular thing we're going to do doesn't have a connection to God in a proper way, then we don't need to follow the rules of God. And whether it's marriage or whether it's some other thing, education, whether it's your family, whatever it is, there is this need to remain true to God in it, and to be very careful about the witnesses. So this, I wanted to tell her when she said, "Grandpa, am I married? If I'm not married, I'm not going on this honeymoon." Well, let me explain to you. What you did up there was one thing. I didn't explain it, what she did. But with regard to the legal aspect where the law of the state of Ohio is concerned, this is all that's required. You have to have your witnesses, but you don't have to have any of those vows. You don't have to have, all of that has to do with God. What you're talking about is what's recorded at the probate court. And that is that you have fulfilled the laws of the state and are recognized by the state as a legally married couple. So I told her, I don't know if the preacher signed the document yet or not. I don't know if she's got the signatures of the other people. And with that, Bob came up and he heard me sing. And Bob says to me, "You could sign it." I said, "Bob, I didn't perform the service." And what it says on there is, it's like a confession. I have performed the marriage. It says, I have performed it. I didn't do it. I can't sign that because I didn't do it. Neither can the guy who did it sign it. And technically, neither can that woman. But I think that in this case, if she was actually physically ill, probably nobody's going to ask about it. And it'll just go to the court. So this is where, are we going to profane the things? Teach that God is profane. This is all just common stuff. Or is there a place where this fits into the law of God and is holiness unto the Lord? And we have to make that decision and then proceed accordingly. And I'm going to stop.